you're going to arrest me and take me away, man.
You got it, yes. Okay, well,
thank you. How do I pronounce your name?
Alec.
Alec?
Yeah.
Hey.
Forget the M.
Not Malik. Really? No, come on. No,
that's true.
I'll call you. Is Malik is the
way. Yeah, you got it.
Hey, thank you.
Yes,
Mr.
Sir.
Dick Bowler.
No problem.
So while we take the long way around to Third Becky Street, since we are not part of the privileged elite with badges, Becky Johnson's with me doing video. What's your perspective on this, Becky?
I think that I don't hear these people who are the best and the brightest of their industry talking about the million people who are in danger of starving to death in Sudan in the next 3 months unless the best and brightest in the world and get together and avert this human rights disaster. That's what I would ask these people who are attending this conference. Instead, I think that they're working on obscure little pharmaceutical drugs that they can market for very expensive prices to very few people, ultimately.
You're saying this, but do you have any actual information around it?
Oh, other than I did a show on genetically modified organisms a while back, and, you know, which really underscored how we... There are all kinds of side effects that the researchers of this who are profit-oriented really haven't considered. You alter a species and you might kill off a butterfly species in the process because it can no longer feed on that kind of plant. Things happen like that.
But you have no specifics about this conference. For all you know, they may be passing recommendations and planning to ship 4,000 volunteers to distribute the necessary food to stop the starvation in the Sudan.
Well, no, I haven't heard any connections between these people or that issue raised generally by leaders throughout the world, but I would think that a biotech industry, the elite there would be on top of what the world hunger situation is. And I mean, they're in the business of providing food, so marketing that to, you know, the world is their market, right? Certainly that they would know about this, but you know the world already produces 1.5 times as much food as it needs. It's a distribution problem, and in the case of Sudan, it has to do with a military war that's going on and a government that's purposely trying to starve off a million people.
The officers who are guarding a large grassy area, to make sure possibly that terrorists do not infiltrate to lie on the grass, reassured that people are being kept away from the grass here. It looks like it's kind of like Iraq. They have, of course, I guess people don't have the AK-47s out here. Well, so are you being kept off the grass? How do you feel about the police here?
Oh, well, I don't know.
Would you rather be, you know, lolling about on the green, or kind of you're sitting here on the concrete. Right in front of you is this sort of barricade that extends quite a ways. Are you here to just sort of, taking in?
We're going to wait in the garden, but of course we can't, so we're waiting here.
What about, is it those awful protesters that have produced this situation? What do you think?
The protesters?
Yeah.
Well, protesters.
I mean, if they weren't protesting this bio, our necessary need to move into a more meaningful genetic research, the police wouldn't have to be here, right?
I'm not quite sure I know what you're aiming at there.
I'm being sarcastic, actually. Hey, this is for Free Radio Santa Cruz. We're doing a kind of a quick trip up here to see what the protest is all about. You're local or from out of town?
Actually, I'm French. But I'm living here for a year and working
here. French, but you sound like you have an English accent. Now, what is this? You moved to England when you were a child.
Right.
Well, Thank you. You want to say who you are for Free Radio?
No, thank you.
Well, thank you.
But, you know, I agree with you about everything.
You like my T-shirt.
Yeah.
I have my my Fuhrer is on the T-shirt, yes. He's the one. Okay, I just purchased a street sheet from a man in the shade here along, what is this? Is this?
This is on 738 Mission Street.
And you actually, you're at the edge of a police-occupied zone, the entire Moscone Center. Have you been here all day?
No, I've been resting because of the fact that I have low blood sugar. But the reason that they have this going on is to the biology Tayo Beck is in. And what it is that they're blocking off all the sections where we can't even use the restroom here and being homeless at this point because of the fact that all the technologists is in. And we do have... what they call a protest.
Have you seen any of the protests happen yourself?
This morning.
How'd that go?
It went okay because they just, you know, they had their helmets on, but it went okay so far.
The police had the helmets or the protesters had the helmets?
No, the police have the helmets. The protesters just walked by with their signs and stuff.
And were they? What was the police response to this?
They were just standing right there. That's how they do it and make sure that you're...
I understand there was some incident where pepper spray was used and there was some blockage of traffic. What was that? Did you see that or did you just hear about it?
No, I didn't see that. That's by Marriott where they started to mess with the police. They can use the pepper spray.
Okay. And what's your feeling? Have you seen a lot of protests in San Francisco? Have you been on the streets a while?
I've seen a lot of protests, but... For me, I don't protest that much. I'm not a protester. They protest because they come up. Like, for example, a couple of weeks ago, we had the gay community come up because they didn't get married real fast. So they had to go up to, you know what I mean, to the federal building up here. But
what about the homeless community? I understand there's been some attacks on this Gavin Newsom's, you know, clean them off the streets, can't panhandle on the medians, cutting GA, that sort of thing?
Yeah. They cut the GA down to $69.
And what's your reaction to that?
I was hoping that they'd keep it up to $160 so you could afford an apartment. But now what they're trying to do is just work out to where you can get a home and then it's just $69 a month. But instead they cut it by $100. And your food stamp card went from $140 down to $80.
How are the delegates treating you? Because you're a visibly homeless person. You've got your street spirits here. You got a white bucket. You know, presumably you would accept donations, right?
Yes. Yes.
Have you been noticing more donations from people from the convention left?
It really depends on the people that live here and the tourists, and whether or not they're willing to do it. The only way I can find a job is either window washing or selling my street sheets right now.
But I mean, here in terms of this convention, with all these people walking around with these badges on,
right.
Have they been a friendlier crew to you, or have they been less? Have they been putting out money, or have they been kind of pretty stiff about it?
In my opinion, they're really tight about it.
They're pretty tight.
Yeah, because their hotel rooms are expensive. They want to see San Francisco.
And give you 25 cents.
Yeah, they don't even want to give you a nickel.
Right. What about the police? Are the police treating you differently in the last 4 days because of this protest situation?
In this situation, the police are fine with you as long as you're not out causing any whatsoever of a disturbance.
When you sleep at night, are you finding police are coming after you for sleeping?
I go to Greyhound, and I sleep down there, that where you got water in the morning and a place to use the bathroom.
How many people use that area, would you say?
I would say a little over 50.
And the police hassle them?
Highway Patrol will come in and say, look, if you're resting, you got to go. Sure, they'll do it at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Has that happened to you recently?
Sure, last night.
So what do you do when they do that?
I just get up and leave.
So you get that treatment in different places, or is it sort of a natural part of the expected routine on the street?
Well, what it is that you go places to where you learn to where it's okay to sleep and where okay to rest by Jesus, the Bible. You go where it's okay by, like for example, right now I could go into Greyhound just to get a drink of water. We're just only 2 blocks down, but you just go different places. You have to, when you're homeless, you have to be on the move.
What's the scene as far as violence? Have you found yourself the recipient of any kind of violence on the street?
I've had my backpack ripped off. I got a haircut today. This is just healing up right here.
It's like a scar on your head.
Two guys are fighting and threw a bottle. Well, I was just reading my own paper, and it hit me on the head.
Any problems with police?
No problems with the police whatsoever. Okay. The police are really nice. They're here to serve the community. They'll ask you, even if there's any problem. I've had no problems with the police.
And we've been talking with...
Pardon?
Your name is...
My name is Michael.
Michael, I'm Robert.
Nice to meet you. That was my dad's name.
Well, it's a good name, I must say. Hey, thank you. And we'll be playing this on Free Radio Santa Cruz probably Thursday, maybe Sunday, down in Santa Cruz. It's a teeny tiny station. You probably can't get it here. But if you get access to the Internet, do you ever get access to the Internet?
The only way that I can do that is if I go to the library and they'll let me only have 15 minutes on the Internet. That's it, because I'm homeless.
Well, other people will hopefully hear you. Thank you, Mike.
All right. Sure.
Mike at San Francisco, last Tuesday up there on the fringes of the biotech Moscone Center, conference that was held at Moscone Center. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM. I'm Robert Norse, and this is Bathroom Spears Broadsides. We've got about an hour and a half left in the show. Kind of skipping around from one topic to another today, but there's nothing new in that. You want to call in, the number is 427-3772. Here's an article from the, looks like another article from the Guardian, London Guardian, that is. Blair, that's the Prime Minister of England, urged a protest at legalization of U.S. torture by Tom Happel. Amnesty International today called on Tony Blair to protest against the U.S. administration's supposed legalization of torture when he meets the U.S. President George Bush at the G8 summit. I guess he already did. Well, I guess he either did or didn't protest. The human rights group was responding to allegations that U.S. Justice Department lawyers had advised the CIA that torturing Al-Qaeda suspects may be justified if it was, quote, in order to prevent further attacks on the United States. The legal advice came in a memo which was published Tuesday in the Washington Post. That was the earlier memo. It was drafted by the Department's Office of Legal Counsel in August 2002 following a CIA request for guidance. The memo concluded that torture amounts to more than inflicting moderate or fleeting pain and, quote, must be equivalent in intensity to the pain accompanying serious physical injury such as organ failure, impairment of bodily function, or even death. So sort of mild pain or moderate pain is not really torture. It also stated that arguments centering on necessity and self-defense could provide justifications that would eliminate any criminal liability should any U.S. interrogator face prosecution for torturing detainees. The document was believed to have been the legal basis for the March 2003 Pentagon briefing published in Monday's Wall Street Journal, that's last Monday, which stated that U.S. laws prohibiting torture by U.S. forces do not apply to the conduct of U.S. personnel at Guantanamo Bay. And as I read earlier, that's not an argument that Guantanamo Bay is not on U.S. territory. It's an argument that torture anywhere on U.S. territory is justified by A, necessity, and B, self-defense, where self-defense means you're defending the country against the terrorists by torturing a suspect. Interesting kind of extension there. Reminds one a little of the song I was playing, Springtime for Hitler. It is understood to have been drawn up by Pentagon lawyers after the U.S. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld asked for guidance on the logistical, policy, and legal issues associated with interrogation techniques. Despite the evidence that the U.S. administration was examining how far it could go in interrogations, officials insist that detainees held by U.S. forces in Cuba, Iraq, and Afghanistan have been treated humanely, perhaps only minimal or moderate pain rather than severe pain, eh? With the exceptions of some inmates held at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. That is to say, the ones that they got called on. A spokesman for the White House Counsel's office told the Washington Post, the president directed the military to treat Al-Qaeda and Taliban suspects humanely and consistent with the Geneva Conventions. Presumably, President Bush will be saying the same thing when he's hauled before the War Crimes Tribunal in a few years. However, Neil Durkin of Amnesty International condemned the U.S. attempt to seek justification for opting out of international law, saying that the U.N. Convention Against Torture, to which the U.S. is a signatory, is very clear that there is no right of derogation. Yes, that means to opt out. No state may decide it is no longer bound by the provisions of the convention, no matter what the circumstances, he added. The arbitrary use of the new legal advice to say that the U.S. is not bound by the convention threatens to undermine the very credibility of international human rights law. We call on Prime Minister Blair to use the opportunity at the G8 summit to raise his inevitable concerns at the supposed legalization of torture, about the supposed legalization of torture by the U.S. administration. And it's not clear whether he raised those concerns or not, but that was something that was requested. The Red Cross has also asked that Iraqi prisoners of war be released on the so-called transfer of sovereignty to Iraq June 30th. And for those of you who have been kind of looking over the Iraqi situation and this large publicity spin around the June 30th so-called sovereignty turnover, where the U.S. troops will continue to do what they've always done, the consultants will simply, people who are running the agencies, U.S. bureaucrats running Iraq, will now become, quote, consultants, and the U.S.-appointed government will take over. I mean, it's kind of a joke. It's even hard to read without smiling. But one thing the Red Cross has asked for is that Iraqi POWs be released on June 30th, and here's an article about it, which I'm going to read now. And it says, Red Cross urges release of Iraqi POWs. This is an AP article dated today by Sam Cage, Geneva. All Iraqi prisoners of war and interned civilians should be released when sovereignty is transferred to a new Iraqi government, according to rules governing warfare, a spokeswoman for the International Red Cross said Sunday. If we consider that the occupation ends June 30th, that would mean it's the end of the international armed conflict, Nad Damani of the International Committee of the Red Cross told the AP Sunday by phone from Baghdad. According to Article 118 of the Third Geneva Convention, prisoners of war should be repatriated without delay at the end of hostilities. Article 133 of the Fourth Convention says that interned civilians should also be released when the conflict ends. It remains to be seen whether the occupation effectively ends with the handover of sovereignty, however, and Damani stressed that the situation on the ground determines the facts. This is the legal situation. When the conflict ends, the prisoners of war should be released, according to the Geneva Convention, she explained. Therefore, all people detained in relation to the conflict should be released unless there are penal charges against them. Although Iraqis will run their own affairs after June 30th, that's a whopper, about 150,000 U.S. and other coalition troops will remain in the country to help improve security under a U.N. resolution approved unanimously by the U.N. Security Council on Tuesday. After the handover of sovereignty, detainees held by Iraqi authorities will be subject to Iraqi law, but current prisoners who are not released because they face penal charges will remain under the protection of the Geneva Conventions, Damani said. In an interview published Saturday in the daily Neuzercher Zeitung, ICRC, that's International Red Cross, President Jacob Kellenberger said it was unclear which authorities the Red Cross should deal with after the transfer of authority. The ICRC is empowered under the 1949 Geneva Conventions to visit prisoners of war and other detainees and make sure their care meets international standards. In principle, all prisoners of war and interned civilians must be released July 1st, Kallenberger said. If prisoners remain under the responsibility of the multinational troops, then we'll have to check whom we should report to. We will negotiate directly with the Iraqi authorities over visits to prisoners and their care. Kallenberger noted that the legal status of Iraqi detainees remained unclear and that every person has the right to know on what grounds they're being held prisoner. The neutral ICRC, which began visiting detainees of the coalition immediately after the March 2003 invasion of Iraq, has been complaining privately to U.S. authorities about mistreatment of prisoners, but the complaints were made public only when a written ICRC report was leaked following the publication of photographs showing U.S. guards mistreating and humiliating detainees. The word torture, I notice, is not used in this article by the AP, of course. Makes one worry about the Red Cross. The Red Cross was sitting on all this brutality and torture and mistreatment for a whole year, and it took essentially a brave or risk-taking soldier to expose this stuff with some photos before they would they would leak their report. So it's all these agencies that people have so much hope for, the Red Cross, the UN. Remember, you got to remember that it was under UN resolution that the 1.5 million people in Iraq have died over the last 15 years because of the sanctions. And it's because of the Red Cross's silence that we haven't heard about this stuff earlier. The Red Cross, of course, and that of many other people. So, there you have it. If you have any thoughts on this, you're welcome to give a call to 427-3772 and chat about it. If you don't want to call on air, but you prefer to call off air, you can give a call to 423-4833. That's the Huff Line, Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, group concerned with restoring civil rights for poor people in Santa Cruz. Let's turn now to a few street interviews, and you'll see just what's happening on the streets of Santa Cruz.
It's May 30th, about 10 to 3. We're here at Hoffman's Bakery Cafe on a sunny day, downtown Santa Cruz, talking with
Conga Ray.
And Conga Ray, you recently had an encounter with the Santa Cruz Police Department around a very small quantity of marijuana.
Yes, I did.
And what happened?
And, well, they tried to get me for sales, and I had just borrowed a dollar from a friend of mine near the ASTI. And I had less than a fingernail full of weed and $1.86 on me, and then when I got to court, they dropped it right away to a loitering charge and convicted me of that, and they charged me $120 and 3 years probation.
You're loitering in a place where drugs are
known to be sold. And I don't know where on this mall that pot hasn't been sold. I don't know of any place.
Wow. Now, who was the police officer who made the arrest?
I think it's Swanick.
And did he say anything as he arrested you?
Yeah, he said, you're going to do time for this.
He did?
Yeah.
Had he ever arrested you before?
Yes, he did, for a quantity of marijuana I had in my conga drum. But then I've been a member of medical marijuana since 1998, mm-hmm. at the one on Maple Street over here, and the one also that was located near Frederick Street. And right now, currently, I don't have a card because I can't afford it. I guess you have to renew every year and pay money. But the kind of things that are wrong with me, degenerative bone disease and arthritis and depression and stuff, I have a letter from my doctor that says it unlikely to go away and most likely to get to worsen in my life. So it really helps me to smoke a little bit now and then.
Have you had trouble now that the two clubs have closed down?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I've had trouble.
What kind of trouble is that?
Well, I can't. I'm afraid to buy any pot from anybody. I'm afraid to get caught. And so, but like I said, asked you before, I'm seeking a caretaker's job, and I have a lot of skills, house building skills, landscaping skills, and tree service skills. I can paint, I can sheetrock, I can frame, I can roof, I can cut trees down, cut firewood, landscape, do all that stuff, and I have good references around here. I work for a lady named Leah Goodman. And she was the manager of the farmer's market here. And she was pretty nice. She would pay me the $80 that she owed me for 6 hours and then say, there's a beer and a sandwich in the refrigerator, and take off and say, I got to go to work. And she said, pet the dog on the way. And so that's a good reference for me. And also, as far as painting goes, I painted the Tea House Spa, which is right there across from Elm Street Mission. And if someone wanted to see my work, they could do that. And I don't know if it's possible. Could they call into your show if they might have some work for me?
It's possible. Do you have a phone number yourself?
I do not right now.
Well, if you got some work for this man, give a call to 423-4833. And we've been talking with
Conga Ray.
Yeah, Conga Ray is looking for work.
Been here since 1956. I lived here in 78, 79. I've been here for the last 12 years. And now with the new ordinance about music on the mall, I don't feel like I can comfortable to play anymore.
Have you tried recently or not?
Not recently. Last time I tried was, I think, 6 months ago.
What happened then?
Didn't make too much money. Police look at you funny.
Well, in the last 4 months, we've been doing this SAFE, Society for Artistic Freedom and Expression, every Wednesday night in front of New Leaf Market. We play for about 3 hours. You're not likely to make a lot of money, it's true, but it's a way of kind of getting together and taking back the public space that we've had taken from us by the police.
Right. Okay, well, thanks a lot, Robert. I appreciate it. You
call into the Huff line in about a week and ask me what's happening.
All right, will do. Thank you.
And if you have any work for Congo Ray, again, call 423-4833. That's a voicemail. Leave a message, and I'll pass it on to him when I see him on the street.
I'm here at the SAFE event, and it's about 20 to 8 on June 2nd, 2004. But at the SAFE event, we have Sue playing. What kind of a drum is this? I don't know. It has a
tabla.
There's a nice sound to it. But we actually met 13 years ago shortly after you had a very, very traumatic incident with the police.
That's right.
You were at a laundromat.
Yes, I was at the laundromat.
And what happened?
I was sitting in my car with my six-month-old son, baby, infant, and my son's dad, and we were washing diapers in the laundromat next to the 7-Eleven on Portola and 30th Avenue. And apparently someone had stole a couple candy bars from the 7-Eleven. Later we found this out. I was surrounded by gunpoint. The suspect had a yellow car, and I had a yellow Datsun at the time. They surrounded my car at gunpoint, yelling at me to get out of the car.
With your six-month-old baby?
Well, they said I could leave the baby in the car seat. The infant. And I was scared. I mean, I was never so scared. Actually, it was the most scary experience of my whole entire life, not to mention humiliating and terrifying. And I was, you know, mortified. And, you know, I barely could get out of the car. I could barely move, as they were saying, leave your left hand on the steering wheel and open the door with your right hand and get out of the car. And I'm like, please. I thought they were going to shoot me and my kid and my husband at the time. And I got out of the car, and there must have been 5 Santa Cruz police cars, 5 highway patrols, and 5 sheriffs. I mean, it looked like there was 15 cars. They were all surrounded by car at gunpoint.
All on candy bar detail.
Yeah, on candy bar detail. Well, later I found out that the person that had robbed the 7-Eleven stole like 3 candy bars.
Did he have a gun?
Don't know. Never found all of that out. In any case, it was late in the evening, but it was, you know, time to wash diapers. It was about 10 in the evening. And that laundromat was open 24 hours, so that's why. And I was yelling out the window. I said, look, I'm washing my baby's diapers. We didn't do anything wrong. We're just waiting for the dryers in the laundromat. And I got out of the car. I was so frightened that I peed my pants. They frisked me. One of the male cops frisked me. Front. Down. And then, during this time, they got a call and they radioed in and they said, oh, geez, I guess you're not who we're looking for. Gee, we're really sorry about this.
Oops.
You can get back in your car now and we're sorry about this. Go ahead and finish your laundry. Meanwhile,
change your pants.
Right, change your pants. And that was the incident. And I've never,
You still, you walked up to me and you remembered. We haven't actually talked to each other extensively that I remember since that time. We may have seen each other, but...
No, we haven't.
But you remember that incident immediately comes back to mind with full force because you gave me a description of it 13 years ago.
One of the most terrifying incidents in my life.
Did you ever get any satisfaction from the police? Were you ever a lawsuit?
No, I didn't. But, speaking about it now, I wish I would have pursued something like that. Yes, I do. This is wrong. This is wrong. It was completely wrong how I was treated. It was wrong in every way.
Did you attempt to complain, or did you just sort of try to just disappear?
Scared to death. I just got out and did what they said, and then they said, oh, we're sorry, you're the wrong suspect. We heard yellow car, and we saw your yellow car, and so we surrounded you, and that was it.
We've been talking with
Susan Plotkin.
Thank you, Susan.
You're welcome.
Appreciate your reliving this gruesome experience, because I think that although I haven't heard of a specific incident quite like this, this kind of stuff still happens.
Hopefully it will change someday.
Excellent. All right, we're at the SAFE event talking to that dancing fool, Lisa. Hey, Lisa.
Howdy.
Right. All in blue. You're reading some anti-war rag, and you also have some news about a new, sort of an act that's trying to take out some of the more objectionable aspects to the Patriot Act?
Yeah, it's actually an act. It's by the Civil Liberties, it's called the Civil Liberties Restoration Act. It's going to be presented to Congress on June 8th by Kennedy and a bunch of other Democratic senators. And it takes back all it gets rid of all sorts of the parts.
You're doing fine. So what parts does it get rid of? She's always a little self-conscious, folks, but we love her anyway. Go ahead.
Okay, it ends the secret hearings so that the family can find out what's going on. It ensures due process for detained individuals.
Rather than due process?
Something like that.
Yeah.
It establishes an independent immigration court.
Independent?
Yes,
what independent. A concept!
Impartial and fair hearings promised to for everybody.
Ooh, I'll bet.
It also gets going to get rid of the National Security Entry Exit Registration System, which has been having a lot of problems recently.
Mm.
And it's going to make the penalties fit the violations.
The punishment
imagine
fit
that.
The crime.
Exactly. And it's going to require a criminal database that's going to actually work on a daily basis with the National Crime Information Center.
Rather than something that's currently being done? Or you're looking at sort of a brief summary of it here, so we're kind of consulting. This is something you picked up off the Internet. Assigned reasonable penalties.
This was actually sent to the Bill of Rights Defense Committee.
Of which you are the chair at the moment.
Yes, I am. Yes. Uh-huh. And we're really excited about it. I just found out about this like 2 hours ago, so I haven't really had a chance to like, you know, get all my talking about it all smooth and stuff like that. But it looks like a really, really good thing.
Pretty. You're going to be real slick later on, I can tell. You're going to be singing. We'll all be singing the blues, but who knows.
Anyway, I don't know exactly where they've been getting their information up until now, but obviously it hasn't been very
limit
good.
Limit secret seizures of records, mandate reports on data mining, ensure access to evidence, require accurate criminal basis. I'm wondering how much of it actually dumps and how much of it just sort of gently removes as a sort of a token effort. Do you have any, seen any criticism yet? Probably not. This is the first you've seen
this
of
is
it.
I just saw this a couple of hours ago, but you know what? If I find out anything new, I'll call you tomorrow. I'll call you on Thursday. And go ahead and tell you in person what I found out about it.
Excellent. Between okay. 6 and 8 on Bathrop Spears, Brad.
Sounds good.
So this is...
And a note on the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, of which Lisa is the chair. I believe they meet every Wednesday at the... I could be wrong. It might not be every Wednesday. You can go online to be sure about this. But I know they were meeting the last two Wednesdays at the Resource Center for Nonviolence at 515 Broadway. For those who are interested in the group, you can also go online, look for Google for Santa Cruz Bill of Rights Defense Committee. I've, of course, spoken about this issue lots in the past. They recently got a resolution through the Santa Cruz City Council, sponsored by, I think it's Porter and Vice Mayor Rotkin, who ignored completely the original, put some teeth into protections that instruct local officials not to cooperate with unconstitutional raiding expeditions on our rights when the feds come in. Various cities have done this, among them Palo Alto, San Francisco, Arcata. But Mayor Scott Kennedy has accepted the good counsel of City Manager for Life Dick Wilson and City Attorney for Life John Barisoni that this would somehow violate the city charter. I spent some time trying to get some understanding of just how this is the case, and as I understand it, Bill of Rights Defense Committee has actually gotten a volunteer attorney to start working on this issue, and I'm not sure how far they've gotten. I tried to get a hold of Lisa a couple days ago, and she was going out of town on a trip, and presumably she'll get back to me later. If anybody has more information on this, please call in. Let me know what you've heard. It's probably, I'm following it too closely, because, first of all, the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, the likelihood of their getting anywhere, in my estimation, is very low, in spite of really good intentions by a lot of those folks. But I've talked about this in the past. They divorced themselves from other local activists. They tried to play kissy-kissy with Kennedy, even when Kennedy was the one who hobbled any protections against the Patriot Act in the first place in November 2002 in a resolution introduced by Christopher Crone. So they were not blindly naive, and they continue to be, I think she continues to be very overly optimistic, but she is very determined, enthusiastic, and wants to use a variety of tactics. Of course, it would be nice to see some concerns about local civil liberties. You heard earlier poor Congo Ray getting, a medical marijuana user getting hassled in downtown Santa Cruz, convicted of using marijuana, loitering in a drug zone. Thank you very much. And Officer Swanick seizing his medical marijuana. This is happening in Santa Cruz. You know, these violations of civil liberties are being done under the imprimatur of the city council, or at least without their objection. And that's what's going on around us, even as the ACLU, with its one of its board of directors member being the vice mayor of the city, Mike Rotkin, the man who has never found a bad word for the police department in the last 15 years, though he will puff up his record about how he was able to get rid of the Code Blue police who were beating up homeless people in the early 80s. Since then, Rutkin's record has been rather pathetic, unfortunate. Anyway, I will hopefully get more information on what's happening with that in a bit. And now I return you to the, I guess it was safe event number 18. We're going on safe event number 20. If you want to be a part of it, Society for Artistic Freedom and Expression, get together, play some music. Come to New Leaf Market and on the sidewalk between 6 and 9, and sometimes later, on Wednesday nights. That's when we're a jammin' and a yammin'.
Letter to Bush. Lisa, go ahead.
Well, this is the gist of the letter. Basically, what I did is I stepped into his shoes, and this is what came out. And it has to be religious, or he won't relate to it. So it goes something like this. I feel better today than I have felt in a long time. God doesn't make mistakes, and God made you. Therefore, there's a reason for you to be here. I don't know if it's to bring America to her knees or to bring America to a place where there's nowhere to go but straight up, but you are here for a reason. Now, as I said before, God doesn't make mistakes. However, you're not God. Is it possible you're making one?
Let's not be too critical. Remember, put yourself in his shoes. I mean, try to be more understanding. I mean, here's a man who has many problems. I mean, think of using the gentler, a kindler, gentler approach to our future. I mean, after all, here he is. He has all these poor American boys and girls overseas, and these coffins, very inconvenient. They keep coming back. Think of that kind of burden that our leader bears.
This is the only way I can deal with people. I know you call me the kill them with friendliness kind of person, but that's the way I deal with people, is I step into their shoes, and I feel that that's the only way you can try to change these point of view, these people, change their point of view, is by making them listen from whatever point of view it takes. Thank you for your interest.
There you have it, and I will say no more at this point. We're talking to internationally, or at least nationally.
Before we reveal who that nationally and internationally known figure is, another quick note about Lisa on the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. She did have a long chat with City Manager for Life Dick Wilson about why it was that they were not going to allow stronger protections against the Patriot Act, and he said that it would put an undue burden on city employees who wouldn't know whether they'd be hassled by the feds if they didn't, you know, cooperate, if they were told by the city that cooperating with the feds was barred or inappropriate, and they're afraid that they would just give those local city employees just too many conflicts. It would just be a real serious conflict. And actually, I hope to have a fuller report on City Manager Dick Wilson's scholarly analysis of why we need to surrender our constitutional rights at the time being until the fine Reagan, Bush, Clinton courts give them back. We can go into that one later. There's also a good discussion of the Patriot Act between Joe Williams and a critic of Joe Williams, I should say a supporter of the Patriot Act. If you go to frontpage.org, www.frontpage.org, I'm still trying to coax Joe into the studio to do some talking about the Patriot Act, because I don't think the conservatives did a very strong job in that particular situation. I also have my own summary of the Patriot Act, at least some of the provisions. And I'm actually reading a book about the issue because I'm trying to be able to be somewhat more articulate on the issue of the Patriot Act. And about looking amidst my many papers here. Hopefully I will find them, but of course, more likely I will not. Here we go. U.S. Patriot Act. Here are some of the provisions that at least concerned one writer, actually Jennifer von Bergen, speaking at the National Press Club in Washington back in June of 2002 on the constitutional implications the Patriot Act. She notes it allows the government to enter and search your home without ever informing you. It allows the government to tap your phone and computer without probable cause. And the judge must rubber stamp a warrant as long as law enforcement certifies that surveillance is relevant to an ongoing criminal investigation. There's no probable cause of criminal activity required, just that it's relevant to an ongoing criminal investigation. It allows the government to carry out secret searches and wiretaps merely by certifying that there is a significant foreign intelligence purpose. Again, they don't need probable cause, don't need to show there's a crime, just a significant foreign intelligence purpose. It expands the power of the government to designate a group a foreign terrorist organization. That's any group which endorses so-called terrorist activity, which can all be otherwise lawful protest activity, can be designated a terrorist organization, such as protesters at Vieques, Puerto Rico, those against the World Trade Organization, perhaps HUF, or Food Not Bombs. Section 411 allows the government to indict anyone who provides material support or assistance to a terrorist organization, including humanitarian or medical assistance, or even if you do so with the intention of encouraging them to adopt peaceful means, like if you're supporting the peaceful section of some Irish Republican Sinn Féin group. Finally, it also permits the government to arrest and detain immigrants, and it's really a serious attack on immigrants, indefinitely for nothing more than a visa violation. In fact, of the 1,200 known immigration detentions since 9/11 as of 2 years ago, the ACLU determined that only about 5 were detained on terrorism-related charges. And there's a book I'm reading called Terrorism and the Constitution, by David Cole and James X. Dempsey, again written in 2002, which goes into this in more detail, and I hope to have a fuller report soon.
Right-wing gadfly.
I don't even know why he mentioned the story, but it was just, he had one line, said, "We're closer to a totalitarian state than we've ever been in this country."
This is a quote from the Boston Globe, with respect to a debate you had on the issue of the Patriot Act. And again, where was this debate?
Well, the original one was on frontpagemag.com, a real extreme right-wing website founded by David Horowitz, the ex-lefty turned born-again right-winger. And it was with some other woman who's right-winger. I didn't really know who she was. A woman who wrote a book, something about how racial profiling was good for blacks or something. It was crazy. It was a crazy woman.
You've got to put yourself in the police officer's shoes.
Yeah, exactly. evidently. Yeah, so they just picked it up. It was just a kind of an honorable mention. He had really no reason to mention me. It was just gratuitous mention, but it just said, you know, he quoted me on the totalitarian state quote.
This is another person on another website who wrote an article about it.
It was an op-ed, one of the townhall.com, another right-wing site that had picked up on the front page Magcom debate and had written his own op-ed about it, and it got picked up by the Boston Globe. And the first paragraph was a mention of, you know, says Joe Williams, Peace and Freedom Party candidate for Congress, you know, out in California. So that was it. The rest of the article was just total regular right-wing trash, but it was nice to get a mention in the Boston Globe. You know.
Now, what about Scott Kennedy's the Rotkin resolution of the city council that opposes the Patriot Act? Are you feeling reassured now in Santa Cruz?
I don't know. I was out of town. Did something new transpire when I was?
Yes, actually, this woman here is responsible, and her group, for bringing before the city council a resolution, which summarize the resolution for us, Lisa.
The resolution says basically that if the rights of an individual are threatened, that they will consider the precedence of the Bill of Rights over the Patriot Act.
But there's no directive to the police department to not cooperate with anybody.
Not at all. And there's no way to enforce it, and there's no enforcement system at all or anything.
Did this pass last Tuesday? Did I miss something?
Unanimously it passed.
Unanimously passed.
Yeah. Unanimously passed. I have been, of course, a persistent critic of poor Lisa's here, who has simply been trying to get the perspective from all sides and, shall we say, get her foot in the door. Trying to get the boots out of the hall, actually, is my objective. But the original reason the Bill of Rights Defense Committee was formed was to put some teeth in the November 2002 resolution, which actually talked about, I don't think it even really directed city employees, but it was stronger than the current bill, which was
the result of Kennedy's gutting back then. You've examined the two resolutions?
Yes, I have. The whole thing is that we tried for a whole year to get them to put this resolution on the agenda. They put us through all sorts of hoops. We ended up fulfilling what they required, their requirements, and then they took us off the agenda at the last moment. This is 7 months later. We finally have Ed Porter willing to do this.
What's on the agenda has nothing to do with what the Bill of Rights Defense Committee was asking for, does it?
No, but you know, in reality, we've actually found another way that we can maybe get this done, to tell you the truth.
But the thing that happened last Tuesday is not what the Bill of Rights Defense Committee requested in any shape, form, or fashion, correct?
No, it's not at all what we requested, but it also doesn't preclude what we're trying to do.
No, not in fact, cooking, you know, in downtown in June, but I mean, you know, what does that have to do? Should we celebrate cooking downtown in June?
Well, at the Public Safety Committee, they told us that if we wanted, that what we needed to do in order to get them to look at this resolution, and we are in the middle of doing it right now. We have a lawyer who is looking at it. I mean, it's not yet, you know, 100% sure that he's going to take the case, but he is on his own time. He's looking at both the resolution and the charter, and he's going to tell us if he's willing to take the case pro bono, go in front of the city council and speak about it and tell them why it is legal or what needs to be changed.
I'm sure
about
the
it.
City attorney and the mayor will be very interested in what your council has to say.
Well,
I'm putting myself in their shoes. I want you to know that right now.
He just won't give up on it. That's okay. I love him.
Well, give me the lowdown. My understanding, the little I saw based on the agenda, was that there's a little additional that Barisoni or the attorney's office of the city.
Something in the California Election Code. You need to go to the California Election Code. You need to get a petition, pay $200, and have a certain number of people sign it by a certain date. If you have those people sign it by that date, you get your $200 back. Then you present this to the council. They can ask you for all sorts of different paperwork explaining how it, you know, if it's going to affect if it's going to affect them in any financial way. Once they have all the information they've asked for, they have 10 days to vote on it. If they vote no on it, then it goes to the people. Now, that's a pretty exciting development also to have discovered this, is thank you, Annette.
Isn't that the normal initiative? Oh, yeah, that's not the normal initiative process. Normal initiative is you simply put it on the ballot for a citizen vote, because that can be done with 10%, I think, of the registered voters in the city, and it takes, you have 6 months to do it from the time you initially file the papers. But then you have to hold either a special election or usually what the council will do, if you get the signatures to put it on the ballot, is they will try to stop the special election by voting on it themselves, or voting some version of it, actually right before it gets on the ballot.
Okay. Well, we hadn't been working on that until this time, and I personally didn't know about it because I joined the group and nobody was talking about anything like that at the time. So
sort of elementary stuff. Not for you, but for the people who you picked it up from, you would have thought, realizing the city council emasculated this measure in November of 2002. Kennedy was the one who did it, that the new mayor would be less than friendly towards changing it, even with 2,500 signatures. And he showed that was his position in September. And also there were those of us, some of whom were driven from the Bill of Rights Defense Committee meetings, who told the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, get a lawyer now so you can show some legal arguments, not to the council, who isn't going to pay any attention to you. They won't, even when you come back with these legal arguments, but to the community that will pay attention to you because they're concerned about it. Although, you know, I haven't heard of anybody who's been harassed under the Patriot Act here in Santa Cruz, except perhaps for congressional candidate Joe Williams. Joe, have you been hassled?
No, not by Santa Cruz. It's by right-wingers from who knows where they come from or where they live. Some cave somewhere, probably. Troglodyte Junction.
Troglodyte Junction. Are you suggesting some kind of terrorist connection here?
No, it's just funny that in the debate and even in this op-ed that happened in the Boston Globe that they were talking about extreme left and the extreme right civil libertarians. So they tried to make it like the leftists were all opposed, but in my debate I was quoting all these right wingers like Phyllis Schlafly's against it, what's his name, Weyrich, the head of the Free Congress Foundation, and some other fairly prominent right wing leaders are opposed to it as well. And so they had to go on record like, oh, these are just extremists of the left and the right. So it's I guess civil libertarians in this day and age are extremists, so that's their argument has been reduced to that.
Extremely interesting.
Thank you.
You're welcome. What time is it? Can you just...
It's been Ronald Reagan week. Instead of looking at the latest incredibly shocking memos on torture, we get to look at the puss of the torturer. Well, here's a little jokey song from the early 80s by the Capitol Steps about that, about one of his big achievements in Central America.
While I'm sleeping, the Reds are creeping. He has that dream again. Six alive, hey, in 2 days' drive, they could be in Harlingen. Life in Nicaragua was kind of laid back, living in the jungle in a wee little shack. Folks get you when you try to get them back. Thank God I'm a country boy. Ortega's on the cover of the news magazine. He says he's gonna get you and he says what he means. His wife looks fine in them Calvin Klein jeans. That's why I'm a country boy. Well, the future's looking bleaker and bleaker. Ortega's next stop is in Costa Rica. Couple years more, he'll be in Topeka. Chris Dodd, I'm a country boy. Sandinista's got an army with the pills prepaid, and all you're gonna send him is non-lethal aid. He'll only use the guns in a little parade. Yeehaw! Thank God I'm a country boy. Yeah.
And that, of course, was about the Contra War, supplying arms to the murderous Contra insurgents, CIA-backed group in Central America back in the mid-80s, for those of you who weren't around in those days, which Reagan called America's freedom fighters. There's been a lot of talk about Reagan's crimes on Amy Goodman's Democracy Now!, which Free Radio plays regularly, I think twice a day, 8 o'clock and noon, on weekdays, so check that out. I recommend it. Or you can go directly online if you like her stuff to www.democracy.org, democracynow.org, www.democracynow.org. So, this is still Free Radio Santa Cruz, and it's still 101.1 FM, and you may be listening on www.freakradio.org, and I'm Robert Norris, and hey, we got a phone here if you want to use it. We're not afraid if you're not. 427-3772. Let's catch another one of them songs from the way back when.
George's job, should his heart fail? At first his temperature was fine, and then the nurses screamed,
it's 99.
His heart rate, is okay. Dr. Coop is on the way. It's our George, turning blue. Don't let Georgie catch the flu. Is it really dire? Is he gonna get a virus? Gotta keep him alive. Keep him alive. When we hear him sniffle, all the nation's in a tipple. Will the doctor arrive? Doctor arrive. Georgie's the best. Indigestion, somebody help me.
Somebody help him, yeah.
I've got a hangnail.
Somebody help him, yeah.
Keep him alive. And if George's health goes from bad to worse, I'll be declared King Dan the First. I'll take the oath and you'll be shown who pulls the strings behind my throne. Cause if you look, that's when you'll find out who will really rule along with me, who comes in right behind it.
Marilyn!
She'll roll him like a barrel, Danny's not a match for Marilyn. She'll eat him alive,
eat him alive.
With unhappy campers, Danny's barely out of paper. She will
eat him alive,
eat him alive. Georgie Surratt!
And that was the Capitol Steps. It was about Dan Quayle and the first George W. and no, the first George H., actually, H.W. So, we have a caller on the line. I'm going to bring him up here. It's one of our regular reporters who's hadn't been seen for a while, but I ran into him in front of the SAFE event, the infamous Paul Marcelin Sampson. Hey, Paul.
Hi there.
So, you're, I was thinking about you the other day when I noticed kind of joint stories about bus lines being cut back in Live Oak, and also, I guess, some transit drivers taking wage cuts or wage freezes or less wage raises. What's going on?
It's a very interesting story. It I would say it's been somewhat misreported. Basically, it's good news. The union representing the inside metro workers, that's people who are not driving buses, the administrative assistants, maintenance people, and others who run the show, have accepted, the union, SEIU Local 415, has accepted a 0% pay increase for 1 year contract extension. That is unfortunately only half of Metro's employees. The bus drivers are going ahead with their previously agreed contracted raise of 9.4% for the top 60% of the workers and 4.25% for the lower 40%. And that is obviously one of the main reasons why we're going to be having a service cut this year. So my kudos to SEIU 415 for making the offer that they did, and for management also for accepting the same offer, and we can only hope that the bus drivers will also moderate their demands this year.
So I know in the past we talked about this, and you kind of put a lot of the problems, economic problems, on the shoulders of the bus drivers. If you want to give the community, you've been going to Metro hearings, Metro Board hearings for a couple years now, or
about a year. Let's see, it's about a year and a half now, I think.
Well, now, what's the entire budget for a year of the Metro?
It's about $32 million right now.
And what percentage of that goes to the bus drivers?
The bus drivers, it's difficult to separate it out. What I can say is that payroll for all of the employees and costs that are directly attached to payroll makes up about $18 million or so. And then there's an additional $5 million or so in benefit costs that are not related to wages, for example, health insurance. It's number of people you have working there times number of months employed. So
23 million out of a total budget, again, of
32 million. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's very typical. It's a service-intensive industry, so obviously most of the money coming in goes directly to wages and benefits. There's nothing surprising about that.
How many people does a Metro employ?
Metro employs about 300 people and dropping, unfortunately.
And how many are in the upper level management?
There are only I'd say seven core managers. It's a very small management team, and there are a few other people who sort of tag along in the non-union/management group who are really mid-level or lower-level managers. But it's basically seven core people who are running the district.
And how, where's the revenue for the bus situation come from? Is it state, local, federal? County?
Half of it comes right out of our pockets in a half-cent sales tax for Santa Cruz County. One half-cent on all the taxable items we buy goes to Metro. And then another one quarter or so comes indirectly from another portion of the sales tax. And then there's a small federal subsidy, a small state subsidy. And then fares account for about 20%.
Hmm. So, you know, I'm looking here at a street sheet, the current street sheet up in San Francisco, where there's a critique of the existing proposed cutbacks of health services, support services. And there are four proposals that the Coalition on Homelessness seems to be proposing. I want to kind of run these by you and see if you can think of some analogous kinds of measures we might use down here to raise revenue.
Okay.
One is amending the payroll tax to clarify that payroll expense includes partnership compensation. This would raise an estimated additional $13.5 million up in San Francisco, which, of course, is bigger by a factor of about 15 or something. Two, establishing an occupational license fee on incomes over $150,000 per year, which they estimate would raise $26 million. Three, adopting a vehicle license fee for San Francisco, raising an estimated $64 million. And then adopting a progressive gross receipts tax, which would raise an additional $30 million per year. It's been also been proposed at different times there'd be a real estate profiteering tax, that there'd be a transient occupancy tax. What kind of progressive revenue measures could we recommend here in Santa Cruz that would lift the burden off the poor and put it on the... eat the rich, so to speak.
Well, first of all, I have to say it's very interesting you brought up these San Francisco tax measures. I, of course, own my own business, and in San Francisco, when I lived there, I was subject to some of the taxes that you just mentioned that do exist already. And they were originally cast, and as they still exist today, they fall disproportionately on small businesses. Basically, they start with flat rates, and no matter how small your business is, no matter how little you earn, you've got to pay at least the flat rate. And the state does the same thing, too, to small business owners. So what these groups may see as progressive taxes have a regressive side of them, unfortunately. It is certainly possible to write a new tax bill that says, well, we're only going to charge companies that earn $200,000 or more, and we're not going to charge other folks anything. But as the laws exist today, the small businesses pay flat rate taxes to the city of San Francisco and also to the state. As far as which ideas would work here in Santa Cruz, many of those are very good ideas, but what the advocates of raising taxes forget is that California has obviously a very strict political framework for raising taxes, and you need a two-thirds majority vote to approve a tax increase of the sort discussed there. The only tax increase you can approve without two-thirds, with only 50%, is a general sales tax increase. And we just did that in the city of Santa Cruz, obviously, a 0.25% temporary increase. But to get a two-thirds majority on a specific tax increase of the sort that you just mentioned is very, very difficult, and it takes a long time. The highway bill, Highway 1 widening, is a perfect example of that, and it's very likely to fail after, you know, perhaps 15 years of, you know, people desiring that improvement and 3 or 4 years of actual work on a proposal that includes all kinds of different interest groups and projects for everyone. There's something in there for bike advocates, there's something in there for school children, there's something in there for drivers, there's something in there for bus riders, and even that is a doubtful win. So we're talking at Metro about balancing a budget that starts for a fiscal year that starts July 1, and you cannot pass tax increases in that time frame if you can pass them at all.
I was thinking more in terms of future years.
Yeah, that will work if you can get the community support for it. Now, considering that the highway widening measure is not likely to pass right now, it's polling at 64%, and you need 66.6. I think it would be even harder to raise money specifically for Metro. Metro has, unfortunately, a negative reputation in the community, and even if it didn't, it touches a very small number of people, and it touches a disenfranchised group of people. Transit riders tend to be low on the economic scale. They are less likely to vote. Many are not allowed to vote. We don't have political power. So, you know, the money, if you could raise taxes, you know, some of the taxes that were discussed there, chances are the money would go to other causes that do have political constituencies behind them.
Now, you've been also kind of going to these meetings and instrumental in trying to form new groups and new restructuring of Metro support groups. You want to give us an update on how things are going with that?
Well, the Metro's new official advisory group is meeting. There will be a meeting next Wednesday for folks who'd like to come to it. It's at 6 p.m. at Metro Center in Santa Cruz. But the group that I founded, the Writers Union, is really in dire straits because I can't get folks who are interested in doing the outreach work. Really, the whole point of the group I founded was to go and do outreach and involve new people who do not consider themselves participants in the existing political process. Going out and talking to bus riders, meeting with them right at the transit center, handing them brochures, things like that. And it's funny, I'm meeting with all kinds of folks in the community who want to help out, and they want my help to solve their specific problems, and they're not looking at the broader outreach side. We're not here to solve my transit problems. We're here, or your transit problems, we're here to bring in new people and get new folks involved, and I'm having trouble recruiting volunteers to do that.
And you are, in fact, working with, in fact, you are the founder of Metro Writers Union, is it .org?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
For those who are interested, www.metrowritersunion.org. We followed your career with some interest here, me, myself, and I, here at the studio, and I think others, too, as struggling as you if you have to get literature out to the community, and to some extent with an intransigent bureaucracy there, you're able to finally be allowed to distribute literature at the Metro after several months of barriers.
Yeah.
But now you find even as you distribute it, people will say, help me with my problem, but I don't want to help anybody else with theirs? Or?
It's not that they're saying that directly, but that's the effect of it. I've been meeting with a group of folks who've just, you know, I guess appeared to me recently and gotten to know me recently, and I've been, you know, giving them a lot of information and tips and pointers, and we're just now getting to the point where they're really up to speed on how Metro operates. And the challenge for me is to help them now maybe overlook their own little transit problems a little bit and then come and help out with the outreach work, writing newsletter articles, distributing newsletters. We'll see what happens, but
so
that's really what I need.
I'm sorry, how many people are in the group?
Well, that's a difficult to define question. We have about 20 signed up for our bulletin board, and you know, I have a network of, I'd say, about 5 or 6 people who I can call upon directly to do stuff. But it's a struggle.
Huh. Yeah, I know the feeling.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. If people do want to get involved, what should they do?
They should call me at 831-421-9031. Or email info@metrowritersunion.org, or come to the public hearings. And that's really what I wanted to, what most important thing I have to say today is not about work that I'm doing or about Writers Union or anything like that. There is a series of public hearings this week and next about the service cuts that will happen in September. And if you would allow me, I'd like to read off the dates and times.
Sure.
For people. So those are Monday, June 14th at 4 p.m. and 6:30 p.m. at Santa Cruz City Council. Chambers, 809 Center Street, in Scotts Valley on Tuesday, June 15th, again at 4 p.m. and 6:30 p.m., and that will be at the Scotts Valley City Council Chambers. That's 1 Civic Center Drive.
This is Tuesday, June
15th.
15th.
And then on Thursday, June 17th, again at 4 p.m. and 6:30 p.m., at the Cabrillo College Watsonville Center. That's in downtown Watsonville. It is Cabrillo College, but it's their Watsonville extension, and the address is 318 Union Street. And I'm not sure whether there will be translators, but I assume that there will be for Spanish speakers. In Capitola on June 23rd at 4 p.m. and 6:30 p.m. at the Capitola Mall in the community room. And that's, well, everyone knows where the mall is. It's 701 41st Street.
Yeah, there's also, of course, a budget hearings coming up at the Board of Supervisors. I guess it's Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, 9 o'clock. For those who are interested, at least that's what the Sentinel claims, if I'm remembering the schedule correctly.
Point out also that Metro's budget is completely separate, and that Metro will have its own budget hearing the fourth Friday of this month at 9 a.m. at City Hall. So another meeting to go to.
Meeting City.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess folks can go to those meetings. And the particular kind of help you're looking for is what?
Is really for bus riders themselves to start writing newspaper, you know, newsletter articles. We need 125-word articles that are can be in English or in Spanish and use simple language so that they can be translated in both into whichever other language. And so again, the 125-word limit is very important. We're aiming to reach people in a quick, convenient format. We don't want essays the way that I write them. So we need folks who will write about, and they have to be bus riders who've had experiences and have concerns, want to write these kinds of articles. We need folks to help us hand out newsletters. We need folks who would be interested in forming relationships with community groups, particularly in the South County area and with the Latino community. But with any, you know, if there are civic groups, churches, work, you know, employee associations, etc., we really need links to those groups.
Yeah, I guess people can call you at 421-9031 if they want more information.
Yes, they can.
And they can also go online at www.metrowritersunion.org.
Yes.
All one word, small letters.
Uh-huh.
Anything else you wish to report?
Just to say that, you know, again, people have read in the Sentinel, and I think I've given a clarification of what's going on with the raise question, that I really would like to see Metro, and this applies to all the other local government agencies here, all the other LGAs, as they're called, get onto a sustainable financial path. When we talk about service cuts, we're talking about layoffs. It's not good for the junior employees who get laid off. I'd like to see a sustainable path, and for me that means that we index wages to the consumer price index so that we'll never see another year of 0% increases. We'll be less likely to see more years of layoffs. People's wages will keep pace with inflation on an annual basis. We're not going to have these years of 10% raises. We're also not going to have the 0%. So that's my hope, and I don't know if there's any political will here, whether it's with Metro or the city or other organizations, to kind of change the policy so that we don't have these crises every few years.
Is there any truth to the rumor that you've decided to volunteer for service in Iraq?
No, and I can't. I'm gay, so I cannot.
Well, don't ask, don't tell. I mean,
that doesn't mean. Well, I'm out, so I've already, you know, on the surface, I've already violated that policy. So, unfortunately.
Well, how about the possibility of running for Santa Cruz City Council?
It's something I consider. Someone, one of my friends in the Writers Union and one of the Metro Advisory Groups called me up, and he said, when is the deadline? When are you filing? So it's something that I'm still considering. I don't see much hope in being elected, and I wouldn't run a campaign just for the sake of speaking out. I would run it for the sake of being elected and I hope making some difference. So I don't know.
Yeah, it requires a huge organization, or at least a significant organization, and funding and so forth. I hear that they were close to doing it, a Rainbow Coalition, in the mid-80s, but that's the last time I think there was any real opposition candidates. I suppose in a way Celia Scott might have been viewed as an opposition candidate. But anyway, Paul, we're glad to talk to you. Call again.
Okay, thanks again for wonderful reporting. I'm just tuning in now today, but I always appreciate hearing what's going on.
And I love the praise, so thanks.
Okay, take care.
All right. Thoughts, give a call. You can speak up on them at 427-3772. That's Free Radio's voicemail. Actually, that's Free Radio's real voice line. You can also talk to me on the Huff line, which is a voicemail in case you want to catch me off air. Looks like we have a real person calling in, or I should say another. Hi, it's Free Radio. I'm Robert, and you are?
Hi, Robert. This is Ray Kahn back with one last observation.
Aha, another shot across the bow, or a brick through the window.
Yeah, you know, I was thinking this last week, and, you know, this last week, in terms of Reagan and his death, we saw more flag-draped coffins this last week on front-page papers than we've seen in over a year of war. What do you think about that?
That's an interesting comparison. No, I hadn't, not until you brought it up.
You know, and the other thing is, you know, all in all, most people that I talk to, I'm 42 years old, most people I talk to, you know, people my age and older really don't really give a rat's ass about Reagan. You know, and this is California State where he was governor. And the younger people, they don't even know who this person is. I mean, you know, you see little kids waving flags for the Gipper. And I'm thinking, you know, they don't know what they're doing. This is brainwashing. This is mind control. I think about the, you know, the symbolism of the motorcade and the whole, you know, the whole presidential death. I think of black psychology, and I think of I got another call. But anyway, I think of the celebrityism of this, and this is how they, you know, propagate their bullshit by these celebrities out of these very evil people, and then just throwing it all out there. And why everybody's, oh, flag draped coffin, oh, poor Reagan, oh, great communicator. You know, meanwhile, they're pushing all these other agendas going on, and you don't really hear anything about what's going on in the war. You don't really hear anything that's going on about the economy. And I'm wondering, you know, that did he really die? Or did maybe a Secret Service agent, you know, kind of slip him a little Mickey Finn and say, hey, you know, take one for the team, Gipper? What do you think about that?
Well, I know that the V-Man has suggested that Reagan died long ago, and they hauled his corpse out of cold storage because of the resignation of CIA Director Tenet and you know, various other international events they wanted to divert, they being, you know, presumably people in the high up in the Republican administration or in the government, whether it's Republican or Democratic at the moment. Also, V-Man was suggesting that Osama bin Laden's body would be hauled out in late October, immediately prior to the election. So, I have no inside knowledge on any of this.
Yeah, and neither do I, but, you know, once again, it's, like you said, it's a shot across the bow, a brick through the window, and I'm going to disappear around the corner. I'll see you later, Robert.
All righty. Well, here's your quick chance to call in. We have half an hour left in the show, 427-3772, if you want to get online, or I should say on the air, and get in line on the phone line, of which there's actually only one line. So if you call, you'll get in, or you won't. You'll get a busy signal if somebody else is on the line. There's, of course, a war going on in Iraq, and one of the things that I've been following rather closely has been the rebellion of Muqtada al-Sadr, who's with his army in Sadr City. And essentially the rebellion against U.S. troops, the Shiite rebellion, and that's been kind of downplayed recently. There's been talk that there's a sort of a reconciliation between the Muqtada al-Sadr and the head of the religious, one of the religious bigwigs, al-Sistani, and that he's going to try to join the government, and that everything is getting rosier. Here's a different view from Juan Cole on his website. I think it's called Informed Consent. And it's called Riot at Iman Ali Shrine Clashes in Sadr City. Sadr City, a Sadr spokesman said late Friday that one Mahdi army militiaman was killed and several others were wounded in clashes with American forces in Sadr City, Baghdad. Reuters television footage showed Muqtada's fighters firing machine guns and tossing hand grenades at American troops, who replied by calling in attack helicopters to open fire on insurgent positions in the Shiite slum. All this happened early morning on Friday. A Sadrist clergyman, Sheikh Nasser al-Saidi, preaching at the Al-Mukha Mosque, warned nations considering joining the multinational force in Iraq that they will be treated the same way the present occupiers are treated. We will not permit any state to send its troops to Iraq, and we will deal with any state that supports the occupation as an occupier. He attacked the caretaker Iraqi government for asking that coalition troops stay in the country, saying that even some European countries, had called for their withdrawal. He asked whether this government is actually capable of holding free and fair elections. He also cast doubt on the loyalty of the Kurdish ministers and officials to Prime Minister Iyad Alawi, saying that they still looked for guidance to the Kurdish leadership, so this government has multiple centers of power. At the Friday prayers at the Kufa Mosque, Sheikh Jabir al-Kafaji preached in the stead of Muqtada al-Sadr, reading the latter's prepared sermon for the third row in a week. During the sermon, he mentioned that Muqtada al-Sadr would support the caretaker government if it demanded a timetable for the withdrawal of occupation forces from Iraq. He emphasized his refusal to kowtow to the occupiers. He advised the Mahdi army to make themselves a firm shield for the Shiite religious leadership and Shiism and Islam, and for all of them to turn to God. He said America has injured minority rights in appointing the caretaker government. This last sentence seems to be a play for Kurdish sympathy, which is odd, since Muqtada Muqtada has often attacked Kurdish plans for semi-autonomy and for annexing Kirkuk. The wire services are misinterpreting the statement as an about-face on Muqtada's part. It is not. It is a piece of bargaining. He is saying that he will swing the Sadrist movement around to support the transitional government if it will commit to throwing the Americans out of Iraq on a strict timetable. This is what Muqtada has wanted since the fall of Saddam. He started calling for U.S. withdrawal in April 2003. It seems probable that one reason the Americans came after Muqtada in early April 2004, intending to kill him, was fear that he will become powerful enough after June 30th to lobby effectively for the expulsion of the Americans. It has now come out that the U.S. military actually printed up broadsheets announcing that Muqtada had been killed resisting arrest, and that some GIs jumped the gun and actually put some of those out in early April, even though, in fact, Muqtada eluded his American would-be murderers. Paul Bremer's recent attempt to ensure that the major Sadrist leaders are not allowed to run for parliament has the same goal. The civilians in the Department of Defense, such as Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz, probably went to war against Iraq in part precisely to get bases there. The realization that they might be tossed out at the instance of a few million Shiite slum dwellers has so infuriated them that they attacked the movement without provocation, killed about 1,000 of them, and are now trying to disenfranchise several million Iraqis by disallowing Sadrists from holding office. And if you may not remember, but Muqtada al-Sadr is barred from holding office because he had an independent militia that did not surrender to the central militia authority. I guess there were nine militias that joined up with the central government. His did not. Muqtada has so far cleverly outwitted and outflanked this American attempt to marginalize him on the political stage. Although his ghetto youth gangs, which are not really a Mahdi army or army of any sort, are easily defeated by U.S. troops and firefights, they cannot be made to disappear permanently by this kind of foreign pressure. If foreigners occupied Los Angeles and engaged in some clashes with ghetto groups, like the Crips and the Bloods, do you really think the gangs could be wiped out by these foreign military incursions? Of course not. The foreigners don't have a prayer of uprooting a phenomenon even local police could never crush. Before noon on Friday, a procession left the 1920 Revolution Square for Najaf, consisting of hundreds of persons who then headed for the shrine of Imam Ali. They chanted for the unity of Muslims, i.e. in support of Grand Ayatollah Ali Sistani and his ally Abdul Aziz al-Hakim, leader of the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq. The march had been called for by Sadr al-Din al-Kabanji, the Najaf head of the Supreme Council. When the procession arrived at the entrance of the shrine, they were met by a group of Mahdi army militiamen who advanced on the protesters, chanting, "Yes, yes, Muqtada," and "Yes to al-Sadr, Muqtada is here to stay and powerful." Both groups entered the shrine, then fell to fist fights, leaving a number of persons wounded, among them Fatah al-Musawi, a Supreme Council official, and Bakir al-Kabanji, brother of Sadr al-Din, who is advisor to the Supreme Council. He was wounded in the head by a stone. The Sadrists then destroyed the pulpit from which the prayer leader preaches and tore up posters of the Grand Ayatollah and Muhammad Bakir al-Hakim, the Grand Council leader killed by a truck bomb last August outside the Najaf shrine. They ripped up the canopies set up to provide shade to the worshippers in the courtyard. Then they used the debris to beat the Supreme Council demonstrators and the worshippers who were waiting to perform Friday prayers. The Sadrists at one point pelted the Supreme Court supporters with stones and shoes. In the end, the Supreme Council clerics called on their followers to depart. Friday's prayers had to be canceled. Although it is said that this is the first cancellation since the fall of Saddam, in fact, al-Kabanji was on a recent occasion unable to complete his sermon because of Sadrist heckling. Sheikh Ahmed Shabani from the Najaf office of Muqtada al-Sadr said that ignorant persons from both sides harassed one another to the reverberation of shouts. Owais al-Khazali, Sadr's spokesman, explained Friday evening that we received a warning from the governor of Najaf on Thursday via the Shiite house that some had the intention to attack the old city and to reach the shrine of Ali with the support of occupation forces within 24 hours. The Sadrists have suspected for some time that the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq and its supporters are doing espionage work for the Americans against Muqtada. If rumors were flying that the U.S. was going to make one last attempt to arrest Muqtada before the turnover of sovereignty and that the Supreme Council was helping them, it would help explain the outbreak of fisticuffs in the shrine. On Thursday and early Friday, Mahdi Army militiamen looted and burned a Najaf police station after the police attempted to arrest an aide to Muqtada al-Sadr. Although U.S.-installed Najaf governor Adnan Zarufi accused the Mahdi Army of breaking the truce, it is hard to see how the attempted arrest was consistent with the truce. That arrest was not in any of the media reports that I read, except this. This is the first time I've read about it. Zarufi is probably egged on in these matters by Paul Bremer and the Coalition Provisional Authority, but note that the U.S. offered him no help on Friday. I think it is a legitimate demand that militias not appear in the streets armed. I'm not sure trying to arrest Muqtada's aides is so legitimate. And that was posted by Juan Cole on his website, Informed Consent, which you can get at www.informedconsent.com. And I have got more articles as well, but how about a little music to break up the monotony of my endless droning? Advertiser, which is actually going out of business shortly. Its editor is moving to Eugene from Boonville, and there's a I'm gonna miss it though. Maybe he'll be doing a newspaper up there from which I can read the column that I'm regularly addicted to, Fred Gardner's Cannabis Notes, and this is about the drug war, about the struggle for medical marijuana, and also the struggle to decriminalize other drugs and other forms of alleviating pain, and other to stop attacks on doctors who are trying to do that. We heard interviews last week with the Millers, and we heard about Dr. Fisher being arraigned for murder and held in jail for months and months and dragged to the court for 5 years, these two pharmacists, pharmacist and his wife and a doctor, for prescribing medication to poor people in a way that antagonized the state bureaucracy. Well, here's a story, Mourning in America, and it's mourning as in mourning, like mourning the dead, and this ties in with the last week of hubbub and nonsense around the Reagan funeral and such. Talks about Reagan's record around marijuana, and it's an interesting historical look back. I'm going to read it. It's in the June 9th Anderson Valley Advertiser. Several phrases associated with Ronald Reagan are likely to endure in the anthologies of famous quotes. Just say no, of course. The evil empire, perfect for a constituency raised on cartoons. Ketchup is a vegetable, his administration's rationale for cutting back on real food for school children. We also owe homeless as a noun to Reagan. His tangible accomplishments include destroying a secular government in Afghanistan and a would-be socialist government in Nicaragua, and allowing the CIA to blow up the Soviet natural gas network, the biggest fire ever seen from space. It pierced the ozone layer. First time I'd heard of that. The escalation of the war on drugs in the Reagan years is recounted in a fact-filled history called Smoke and Mirrors. Author Dan Baum describes Reagan outlining his goals to a convention of police chiefs soon after taking office. Quote, an end to the exclusionary rule. The exclusionary rule, for those who don't know, is the law that states if evidence was illegally obtained, it must be excluded from any court cases. So if they illegally search you, then they can't use the fruits of that bad search. Reagan wanted the exclusionary rule ended. An end to the exclusionary rule, injecting the military into the drug fight, applause, bail and parole, quote, reform, read abolition, enlisting the FBI into the war on drugs and the responsible use of herbicides. Reagan and his Attorney General Ed Meese realized that the way to maximize the number of arrests and prosecutions was to target marijuana smokers. Meese said at a cabinet meeting, there are still millions of pot smokers in this country who are unaware of the health hazards posed by marijuana and oblivious to the legal standards. Many users don't seem to realize they're breaking the law. If we are to eliminate the drug market, we need to go after users as well as dealers. They had Nancy proclaim to the public, that's Nancy Reagan, his wife, the casual user may think when he takes a line of cocaine or smokes a joint in the privacy of his nice condo, listening to his expensive stereo, that he's somehow not bothering anyone. But there is a trail of death and destruction that leads directly to his door. The casual user cannot morally escape responsibility for the action of drug traffickers and dealings. I'm saying that if you're a casual drug dealer, you're an...